listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, Taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times to Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor. Really pleased to have with me once again Keith Wiener. He is the founder of Monetary Metals. As an Austrian economist, Keith brings with him a unique view of the metals markets. He founded Monetary Metals. That's a company that is proving anti-gold naysayers wrong. They've always suggested that investing in gold was a kind of a dumb idea because you don't get any return, any yield, any sort of return on your investment. Well, Keith is proving that that is wrong with Monetary Metals. They're paying interest on leases and bonds that are at least as good as the U.S. Treasury. And, of course, you get it back. When you get paid back in your gold and you get your interest paid on gold, it is in real money, real non-depreciating money, and unlike the treasuries, which, of course, we can count on losing value over time. So it's really great to have Keith, and I would suggest that you go to J. Taylor Media. That's a website of mine. There's a rotating banner there. If you click on that, it will take you right through to the Monetary Metals website, and you can learn more and perhaps more than what Keith will have time to talk about with me right now. But I want to thank you, Keith, for joining me today. It's good to have you again.
Thanks for having me, Jay.
You know, I just maybe like to start off by asking you sort of a general macro question. What is your current assessment of the global economy and financial markets?
So in order to answer that, I kind of have to take a step back and talk about the Fed sort of as this bipolar, dysfunctional creature. And it has two modes. The mode that everybody loves because it has rising asset prices and rising consumption is a mode where they're pumping out more credit at cheaper and cheaper rates. And that is necessary because of the way the monetary system is designed to keep the economy going. But it also is fueling malinvestment, consumption of capital. And we can get into, you know, why I say those things if there's time. But it's fueling all kinds of bad stuff. And the development of what I'm not a fan of John Kenneth Galbraith, but he coined this term the bezel. Mm-hmm. Which roughly means the difference between the asset values that everybody thinks they have and are holding on their books versus what's really there.
Uh-huh.
And so you get this greater and greater disparity as the Fed is pumping up asset prices, which makes people feel wealthier, which they call the wealth effect, mm-hmm. Which isn't real wealth, obviously. For instance, you get the rise of what are called zombies. Now, mm-hmm. A zombie is not defined by some fringe alt finance, you know, sites. It's defined by the Bank for International Settlements,
right?
The central banker's central bank. And they define a zombie basically as a company whose profits are less than their interest expense. So a zombie wouldn't exist at all, but for cheaper and cheaper credit being pumped out in greater and greater volumes. Anyways, as the zombies rise, the malinvestment rises, the bezel grows, the Fed gets to the point where, and maybe throw in some rising consumer prices, which is happening for other reasons, which we can get into if there's time. The Fed suddenly decides, like, whatever tick goes off in a bipolar, you know, schizophrenic mind, that now it has to switch to the other mode, which is to cause the bust. And so then they pull credit back, interest rates rise, and they, they think this will be the cure for zombies and all manner of malinvestment, which it probably is if they could let it go on long enough. Mm-hmm, but mm-hmm. At the same time, it's also pulling credit back from, you know, all parts of the economy, including the productive sectors. And that's the phase that we're in right now. I don't think they can last very long at this. I think the pain is going to become too intense for, the Fed to, withstand. But, you know, that can go on for a while before they finally cry uncle. And the thing that needs to be emphasized about this, for all that their pretense of analysis and data and equations, you know, having a central bank is the politicization of credit. It's mm-hmm. a political process that now
right.
decides these things. Mm-hmm. So when will the political process turn? Well, it's hard to predict, but it will because it's going to get more and more painful and powerful interest groups are going to demand that they reverse.
Well, it's interesting because David Stockman, who I've had on this show, sort of surprised me when he said he doesn't think that Powell is going to pivot anytime soon because the Fed knows the population is getting angry as hell with all the inflation going on. And so many people, half the population lives hand to mouth, one paycheck to the next. And now with rising prices, they can't hardly, they can't make ends meet. They're hitting their credit cards even more. So David's view was that the Fed won't pivot anytime soon. They know they've got a serious inflationary problem on their hands. They've got to keep it. You know, they're seeing the people with all this anger, as David put it, coming at them with torches and pitchforks. Do you think that Powell will just keep the brakes on until he breaks something, and then there's going to have to be a pivot at that point? Or do you think, you know, politically the pressure just gets so great that they've got it, they can't withstand keeping the brakes on?
You know, it's very hard for anybody, but certainly for myself, to try to predict, you know, political decisions.
Yeah.
So I try to keep myself in my swim lane, which is to look at the economics of it, which is much more, you know, governed by economics law.
Sure.
I think, you know, the Fed plays that caring about inflation. Of course, it's Orwellian. Their mission is defined as price stability. But right on their webpage, they say that, you know, prices rising relentlessly at 2% per annum is price stability. And I think Orwell would be looking down on this and either smiling or angry, depending on, you know.
Jealous.
jealous, right. I didn't think of that, bastards. You know, I think they play at caring about prices. I think they play at caring about unemployment. Does anybody really believe, even supporters of the Fed, does anybody really believe that if you lose your job, Jay Powell is crying a tear somewhere into his wine or beer or beverage of choice? No way. All of that is political cover. Mm-hmm. It's the smoke screen that, you know, they can use to justify whatever maneuver they want to, you know, pull. At the end of the day, I think they care about, and the reason why the Fed was founded was to enable the government and, of course, its crony, corporations to borrow and therefore spend more than they otherwise could, more than the government could raise in taxes, mm-hmm. More than those corporations could get in, you know, honest revenues. And secondarily to that, to keep those cronies, particularly the crony banks, solvent. And, hiking interest rates does a number of things to undermine, you know, bank solvency, two of which are, one, that they've inverted the yield curve. So banks infamously or famously borrow using short-term markets, and they have to keep rolling over their funding at higher and higher rates as the rate is going up. And they use that funding to buy long-term assets, which, of course, are already bought, and therefore they don't enjoy the higher asset price, but they the higher interest rate. Instead, they have a falling asset price on their asset side of their balance sheet. Mm-hmm. So their balance sheet, you know, has pressure because the assets are falling. The income statement has a pressure because the interest expense is rising. Mm-hmm. That's what rising interest rates is doing, or a yield curve inversion is doing to the banks.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then the other problem is that all of this rising interest rates and credit pullback is forcing all sorts of borrowers into default.
Right.
Every one of those defaults is now impacting the banks. Mm-hmm. And I think of it as like blowing holes in their balance sheet. And the Fed surely has to be watching that. And when the pain on the banks becomes too great, unlike the pain of unemployed people, which I don't think they feel and I don't think they care, but the pain of the banks is going to be, especially the big crony banks, is something that I think they're going to have to pay attention to. The question is, when does that, get to a point that they reverse? I don't know.
Yeah, nobody knows, I guess, and you're right. It's impossible to know. So all those zombie companies that have been held, kept alive through infusions of money and lower interest rates for years and years are still there. And as you said, if they'd leave it go far enough, it probably would cure it. But they won't. They can't because the pain is too intolerable. Well, let's get to maybe some pain relief for our investors in terms of investing in gold. And your products that you at Monterey Metals have devised. You were the founder of Monterey Metals. You had a vision for what could be, so people can actually invest, I think, as little as 10 ounces of gold they can put up with you, and then become lenders, and I guess in a consortium or in a group, either leasing that gold or being a part of a gold bond. Is that right?
That's basically it. So deprived of interest in dollars, which are falling anyway, people turn to gold, and our approach is they should get a return on that gold in exchange for doing something productive with it, rather than just hoarding it. What makes the economy go around is finance a productive enterprise. And so we have two programs. We have a leasing program, which is open to all investors. Mm-hmm. Minimum investment is 10 ounces. As you say, we present lease opportunities. Investors have a choice whether they want to participate or not in any given lease opportunity. Interest rates on that range from 2% to about 3%. That is net to the investor, and that's gold on gold. So if you put 100 ounces in, an interest rate of 3% means you get 103 ounces at the end of the year.
Mm-hmm.
A lease is where the company that's leasing the gold has physical inventory or work in progress. So we could go on site, scrape all the gold, put it on a scale, and it would weigh greater than the lease amount. So the gold is physically present. This is not a financial product involving, leverage, hypothecation, or any of those kinds of things.
Yeah.
The gold is physically present, and that's how that works. We also have a product that we call the gold bond.
Mm-hmm.
And a bond is just that, it is lending. So in the case of a lease, it's not lending. The lease gold does not go on the balance sheet of the lessee. It's not their asset. If they were to declare bankruptcy, for example, we would repossess it in the same way that if you lease a car from General Motors, that doesn't go to, the car is not liquidated for the benefit of your creditors. General Motors will just simply repossess it.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of the bond, which is accredited investors only, so I have to be careful talking too much in an open forum. Mm-hmm. That's just the way the securities regulations are in this country today. It is true lending. It does, the funds go on the balance sheet of the borrower. Mm-hmm. And typically we're financing mines, growth and expansion for refiners and vaults and others that are generating a gold income. And interest rates are much higher in the bonds than they are in leases. Obviously there's greater risk.
Right.
If you look at the dollar, there's one good thing about it, which is that there is quite a rich risk return spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
There's everything from holding cash, like in a bank safe deposit box, which has no return and in theory no risk other than the general currency risk. And then on the opposite extreme, I guess you could buy call options on a 3x leveraged ETF. And if you put $1 million into that, you would create a, multi-generational fortune, if I were right.
Yeah.
And there's a product in every risk bucket or every slot along that spectrum.
Yeah.
There's thousands of different gradations. And the gold world has basically had two slots, which is you can buy gold metal. And I would include in that, futures and GLD and things like that. They're just different ways of holding gold metal. Or you can buy equities of mining companies, which is pretty far out on the other end of the spectrum.
Right.
Much higher risk. Obviously, the returns, if you get it right, can be enormous.
Mm-hmm.
And then what we're doing is we're creating products that slot kind of in the middle. The lease is much closer to the near end of low risk and low return. The bond is somewhere out in the middle. Higher risk and higher return, but lower risk than, the equity, right? If a company is failing, the bondholder, the lenders are repaid first before the shareholders would get anything.
Right. Exactly right. Now, Keith, with regard to, maybe just some people might want to just own gold and keep coins in their home or in their vault at home. Okay, that's all right, but someone can come in and rob you. That's a risk that you have. I mean, it might be considered the safest way to own gold, but you don't get any return on it, that's for sure, other than the appreciation against the currency. You can store gold coins. You could put it in a private vault. But as I understand it, if people enter into your program, they're not charged for a vault storage. Where, you know, if people put their money, their gold in a vault or silver in a vault, they're going to be charged a lot of money, right? But is that true that if people invest, say, 10 ounces of gold or whatever with you guys with Monetary Metals, they don't get charged for the gold that's not lent? Because I guess we didn't get to this part, but how, if people put up those ounces, they have to bid on an interest rate. I mean, there's a bidding process, right, that allows a certain number of ounces that are in your program to be invested. Maybe you could clarify that, but the point is that in your program, you don't have to pay for vault storage in any.
That's right. If you have coins at home, you're taking the risk of theft or fire or flood, but you generally can't insure. I've called a number of insurance companies. You can't insure gold held at home. Because it's too easy to commit fraud against the insurance company.
Sure.
You don't have any cost, but on the other hand, there is that risk, and who knows what that risk is. If you live in an apartment in the middle of the city, that risk is probably a lot higher. If you have 50 acres, in a rural place, and you bury it in the backyard, that risk is probably pretty low. If you go to a professional depository, you will typically pay about 0.75% per year, mm-hmm. which doesn't necessarily sound like that much, but, that adds up over time. That gets old, after 10 years of that. I mean, if the gold price was going up at 25% per year, I think most people probably wouldn't care that much.
Yeah.
But if the gold price is, choppy and sideways and whatever, that gets pretty frustrating. And you're absolutely correct. In our program, we do not charge, storage fees for it. Of course, the intention in our program isn't long-term storage. It's to get it deployed productively into something that produces a return, in which case there's no storage fees. There's just a single, net interest rate that we quote. Now, you talked about the bidding process. We are, in the final stages of rolling out something that makes it a lot easier, and that is that an interest rate is presented, and then you just decide, do you want to participate or not?
Mm-hmm.
So all that bidding stuff goes away, which I think, there's some investors that kind of got excited about the game theory aspects of it, but I think, the more mainstream investors probably looked at it, rolled their eyes a little bit, said, okay, well, if I have to do that, I'll do that. But I mean, you're making me jump through hoops. Just make this easy, please. So we've listened to that feedback, and that's coming very soon.
Very good. I'll look forward to that. Well, let me ask you, Keith, before we run out of time here, I want to get your take on or your forecast for gold. You put out a very good report, a very thorough report in January, calling for, sort of forecasting the gold price. And maybe you could just talk a little bit about your methodology that you use in trying to determine in coming up with some sort of a forecast for gold, and just talk to us a little bit about what you were thinking in January and how that might or might not have changed between then and now.
So we look at the spread between futures and spot. The futures market is not a prediction market. It's not what anybody per se thinks the price of gold is going to be in December or February or whatever. It's a carry market, meaning that if you want to buy a February future, then the person who signs up to give you that gold in February will typically, buy the gold, warehouse it, it's locked in his buy price, it's locked in his sell price, and it's an arbitrage. Mm-hmm. So, that difference between future and spot normally represents the cost of interest plus the cost of storage. Mm-hmm. But as you can imagine, as markets gyrate, the price can get pretty distorted from where that should be. Either spot is moving up or down, or futures are moving up or down. And so based on that, in end of January, we put out the report. I think I basically said that we stand at a crossroads. Is the Fed really going to go through with this tightening and hiking of interest rates? And if so, that's not necessarily terribly bullish for gold. And definitely not bullish for silver. What's happened since then, and this is the really interesting thing, obviously the price of both metals has come down, not surprisingly. But what's interesting is, so both metals at that time, we calculate a fundamental price, based on trying to back out, theoretically, you look at the market price, which is comprised of both the spot buyers and sellers and the future buyers and sellers. And the buyers and sellers in the futures market are using leverage, and they're speculators, so they can distort the price. But if we could theoretically calculate how to back that effect out, then we'd be left with, okay, if the market was just physical, where would it clear at? Mm-hmm. And back at the end of January, the market clearing price was pretty close to, I don't remember exactly what the numbers were, but pretty close to the spot price. As the prices of the metals have moved down, the fundamentals have not moved down so much as the market price has. And now today we have a situation where both gold and silver, the gold fundamental price is $100 above the market. And in silver, it's more like $3.50 or something. Mm-hmm. But what's really interesting is that silver has become very scarce to the market. Mm-hmm. Gold conditions are reasonably normal, if I could dare use that word to describe this bizarre environment that we're in which nothing is normal. Mm-hmm. But silver has become incredibly tight, and there is now a real serious backwardation in silver, which means the scarcity or shorter. So we put out a report yesterday based on Friday's data, and yesterday it got even more extreme. We may put out another update if it gets even more extreme today when I look at the data. That backwardation is more serious than anything we've seen since the heart of the global financial crisis.
Ah, interesting.
So, which means, there's potentially explosive upside to the silver price when the market is ready to respond to that tension. That could be quite a lot of force, letting go, like if there's a cable under tension and you cut it, it doesn't just drop to the floor, right? There's a whiplash effect. And that whiplash could see, $24 or $34. It depends. And of course, if there's a momentum that takes over as we had in 2010 through 2011, $50.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. So it must mean that there people want to get their hands. They need silver for one thing or another in manufacturing or maybe for monetary security. But I would guess more in the real world for manufacturing and so forth. And it's just not there, so they have to bid the price up for the physicals. That's what's happening, I guess, right?
It is becoming increasingly scarce for whatever the reason. Uh-huh. Now, regular listeners of your show may know, and certainly regular readers of our reports know, we have not exactly been perma bulls on gold or silver, and we've not necessarily been bullish on silver mm-hmm. most of the time for most of the last decade or so. I don't think we've ever come out with a call this aggressive on silver that I can recall. This mm-hmm. is a very unique moment in time.
All right. We'll have to leave it go at that. We're really out of time, Keith. I'm sorry. I had a bunch more questions to ask you. Maybe we can do it again sometime in the near future. Folks, that is all the time we have this week. Next week, Bob Moriarty will be with me, as well as Quentin Henning, to talk about Lion One Metals. Bob will talk about the money revelation. That's how hyperinflation takes root. It's from an account in hyperinflationary Germany, and it was translated into English. Bob will be with me to talk about that next week. Keith, I want to thank you so much for being with us, and I want to tell all of you, go to monetarymetals.com. You can easily access the website by going to jtaylormedia.com, or just click on the banner there. Keith, thank you so much for being with us, and folks, until next week, goodbye and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.